Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The price of oil continues its free fall. The government insists its budget will not be impacted by this big drop, but it's not clear exactly how long the prices will last and how bad the economy will be hurt. Joining us on the show to discuss the issue is the Bank of Canada Governor, Stephen Poloz.
Speaking of oil, the Prime Minister made headlines this week by calling oil and gas regulations crazy economic policy during this time of low prices. To respond, we're joined by NDP leader Thomas Mulcair.
The Assembly of First Nations now has a new national chief. Perry Bellegarde takes the helm and joins us on the show to discuss the problems facing First Nations. And then the Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcour is here to explain why he's relying less on the AFN to deal with Aboriginal issues.
And the winter break has begun for MPs as the fall sitting comes to a close. The last few months have created a lot of news. The McLean's panel breaks down the big events and the winners and losers of the fall sitting.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Memories of the recession seem to be flooding back these days since oil prices dropped below $60 a barrel, the first time that's happened in 5 years. This is not good news for our economy, and it could have a big impact on the federal government's budget if revenues start to dry up. But Finance Minister Joe Oliver won't speculate on the effect this will have on the economy.
There's a complex of implications, both positive and negative, and there's a lot of volatility, so we'll see where it lands. We're monitoring carefully.
Alberta is already saying the drop in oil prices could mean a revenue shortfall of $7 billion for the province. But the Harper government's House leader, Peter Van Loan, insists the federal budget won't be significantly thrown off, even though most of the surplus has already been earmarked for income splitting and infrastructure funding.
We do anticipate that we will still be able to deliver on a balanced budget while at the same time delivering on these very important benefits that Canadian families want and are expecting, and I'm quite confident we'll be able to do that.
Well, to address the concerns about crude, Bank of Canada Governor Stephen Poloz sat down with Jason Kirby, the business and economics editor for McLean's.
It has seemed like each time it seemed like Canada was gaining traction, something came along, whether it was bouts of low inflation, job growth, now oil prices. Do you think that this is the time, though, where we might finally catch that break? And
Well, oil prices are a pretty big thing for us, and being a net exporter, we are one of the economies that would be a net loser from that. And so that basically reduces the amount of income that's flowing into Canada from outside, and quite significantly so. So it remains to be seen just how all that works its way out. At the same time, it will strengthen economies such as the U.S. So that's where we get this complication of there's ups, there's downs, there's one hand, the other hand, just a typical economist question. For us, we would think it's going to take some growth out of the Canadian economy. After all, those things are netted out, even if the exchange rate is offsetting some of it, and the U.S. economy is a bit stronger, there will be a net negative effect for us. We speculate at this point it could be if the prices stayed where they were, perhaps as much as a third of a point, a third of a percentage point, something along those lines might be the net effect. But we'll do some harder work on that over the next few weeks, and when we do our next monetary policy report, there'll be a lot more detail on it.
One of the key questions is going to be, I guess I want to get your sense of, do you see this as a drop in prices similar to 2008 that was short-lived, or something like we saw in the 80s and 90s, a prolonged slump after a 10-15 year, you know, 10 years of rising prices?
Yeah, that's a hard choice to make at this stage. What we do think is that a good percentage of this this drop is really due to excess supply as opposed to demand. We know the world economy is underperforming in a lot of places, so my sense is that a downturn, or at least a writing down of the outlook, that's a better way to put it, in the last couple of months was the catalyst for this. But the excess supply had been building for quite a while, given the shale developments in the U.S. In particular. And so as a consequence, it's more likely to be longer than what we saw in the 2008 thing. But of course, lower prices usually would mean a little less investment, a little less flow. And it's like any other economics problem, you know, it kind of catches up to itself. We wouldn't expect $60 or $70 to be some sort of equilibrium for a long time, because the cost of producing each barrel of oil in many, many parts of the sector are higher than that. Mm-hmm. So it's just at this point, it's really not one we speculate about. In the MPR, the Monetary Policy Report, we don't do a forecast. Mm-hmm. We just take a convention that it'll stay where it is when we do it.
Right. You've talked about the two-track economy that we do have in Canada. That one track has been driven by the resource boom. Might this bring about a little bit of changing of the tracks, you know, where the Canadian economy might have to switch a little bit? And is that second track, which is more the traditional manufacturing-driven economy, export-driven economy, mm-hmm. ready to pick up the slack?
Well, your supposition is correct, I would think, presuming it lasts long enough to actually get those gears moving in that way. And as we mentioned earlier, lower oil prices have brought with them a lower Canadian dollar, and that comes as a positive news to a manufacturer, let's say in Ontario or Quebec, who have been under a certain amount of stress, and there's that two-track thing. So the resource side has been faster and the manufacturing slower, and you'd expect to see less of a gap. But we should bear in mind that the terms of trade, this is the result of all the commodities that we produce and our net exports in them, not just oil, but other things, okay, have come down, but they're still much higher than they were, say, 10 years ago. So that terms of trade effect is still working its way through. People are still making investment plans based on that. And so I think two-track is probably going to remain a feature. But at the moment, I'd say that the gap between them would narrow. And that's, of course, a more balanced type of growth, which would be welcome, I think, to most people.
Especially in central Canada that has...
Well, obviously, yeah. Like I said, you can't ignore the fact that this means less income flowing into Canada, and that would be felt most obviously in the oil producing or iron ore producing or coal producing areas. So those are the kinds of commodities that have done this. And so there's a slower growth there, that's virtually certain. And whether it then transmits itself into the rest depends on the exchange rate behavior, it depends on the demand from the U.S., which is all part and parcel of that story. Mm-hmm.
Given that you're more optimistic now about the outlook for the economy than you were during the last interest rate announcement, has it changed at all your view of when Canada might see a change in rates?
Oh, well, we don't give guidance on interest rates like that. And when we say that's in the last few weeks, we've had a couple of encouraging data points. You shouldn't suddenly switch the optimistic light on. We're very cautious because we've had a number of false dawns, serial disappointment over the last 2-3 years. Just seems to go on and on. And economic data never go in a straight line. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is see this trend get sustained. Where I've seen the most encouragement is in the export side, where we now have several months in a row in the areas where we predicted we should see that growth returning as the U.S. found its footing. But what we're not sure about now is how sustainable is that in the U.S.? Will they be influenced now by even worse news in the international economy? Will we, through other channels? And, of course, the oil price effect is very hard to guess, as I said before, and we don't really know how big that is yet. Mm. So there's enough uncertainty that it's wrong to start saying, yeah, now we're optimistic. But we are starting to see some pieces come together, and that's a positive sign.
That was the governor of the Bank of Canada, Stephen Poloz, speaking with Maclean's business and economics editor, Jason Kirby. For more on that interview with Poloz, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine or go to macleans.ca. You're listening to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's magazine.
Well, we're going to stick with the topic of oil, more specifically, regulations for the oil and gas sector.
Frankly, Mr. Speaker, under the current circumstances, it would be crazy. It would be crazy economic policy to do unilateral penalties on that sector. We're clearly not going to do it.
That was Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who angered the opposition by indicating they shouldn't hold their breath as they wait for action on the regulations. He said this even though the PM himself promised back in 2006 he would tackle greenhouse gas emissions from the oil and gas sector.
The NDP has proposed that Canada adopt a cap-and-trade system to both regulate and price carbon emissions. And when I sat down with New Democrat leader Thomas Mulcair this week for a year-end interview, I asked him about how the NDP would confront the challenge of regulating the oil and gas industry. One of the issues that came up this week into focus was oil and gas regulations, climate change, and GHG emissions. The NDP's proposed cap and trade in the past, I assume that will be the proposal in 2015. Do you have, at this point, a sense of what targets you want to aim for, what kind of price point you're looking for carbon emissions, and sort of what the cost will be to consumers for that kind of program?
Well, I'll tell you, Aaron, I would love it if my very first action on the international stage, if Canadians give us their confidence and we become the government next October, I'd love to go to Paris for the Conference of the Parties, as I've done in the past when I was Environment Minister, and get Canada back on track. I mean, right now, we're working against the planet. I want to start working with the world to come to a solution to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which, by the way, I accomplished every year that I was the minister in Quebec. So we're going to have to take the situation that we receive from the Conservatives. They don't like science. I know you know that, but we're not measuring very well. It's very hard for us to say it's going to be exactly this or that. We're going to get back on board. We're going to have constraining limits. We're going to make polluters pay and include the cost of their pollution in their product, whether it's carbon pollution or any other form, something the Conservatives haven't been doing. We'll get back on track. We're not there now.
The government's argument is that we can't go forward with this unilaterally. We have to wait for the United States. Why should we go it alone? Why should we go unilaterally?
You know, the same day that China announced in Johannesburg that it was ready to start looking at constraining limits, the very same day, Canada became the only country in the world to withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol. That is a shame, but it's an embarrassment for Canada on the world stage. So I think that we have to get back on board. We've got to start working. It's a real problem. It's been measured. It's been proven. Mr. Harper just doesn't believe in it. He said that in so many words. He says now something that he himself proposed just a few years ago is crazy. So I guess we have to ask Mr. Harper how long he's been crazy, because it was his idea.
But you're not worried that it'll have cap and trade, a price on carbon acting unilaterally wouldn't have a serious negative impact on the oil sands?
The only way Canada's been acting unilaterally is to withdraw from Kyoto. The rest of the world is ready for limits, and we've got to be part of that process. There's never been any talk of Canada being the only party to have to do this, but we used to hide behind the fact that the Americans hadn't moved. Now we're behind the U.S. and China. So I think that Stephen Harper's got to stop going through his Rolodex of excuses and start realizing that the public wants Canada to be on board.
But what's the argument against? I mean, they will say, and they have said a few times now, that your policies are job-killing policies on the environment. So what can you say to counter that? I mean, won't it cost us jobs to act against the environment?
By 2020, the world market for green renewable energy technologies will be $3 trillion. Canada's not going to be part of it in any meaningful way because our government doesn't believe in creating the next generation of well-paid jobs. That's the type of technology that will allow us to replace a lot of the things that are burning the fossil fuels now. That has to be part of the plan. Instead, they want to ship our natural resources, including bitumen, raw to the Gulf Coast of the U.S., not even bothering to add value here in Canada and to add jobs here. So that's their approach, rip and ship. Our approach is add value, add jobs, get a better price for our product, different approach. We have that different vision. It's different from what the Conservatives and the Liberals have been doing for years. Now Canadians are looking at us in a different way as well. It's the first time we've been the official opposition. We had two jobs to do to convince them that we could keep moving forward. One is we have to hold the government to account. I can assure you Stephen Harper does not enjoy question period. And we've also been able to show that we are a government in waiting, and that's what we're going to do on this issue and all the others.
Would an NDP government be set on hitting those Copenhagen targets? Economists have looked at the numbers at this point and said, you know, it's next to impossible to still hit that 2020 goal. It would require maybe $200 per ton of on a price on carbon emissions. Assuming, you know, an NDP government in the fall of 2015, you go to that Paris conference, can you still say at that point that you're going to hit those Copenhagen targets?
Anything that we sign on to, we will achieve under the NDP. And again, people can look at my track record. I've actually done this. It's not theoretical in my case. The other thing that people should know is that this reminds me a lot of the situation that existed in 06 when the Liberals left power. They had been boasting and talking about signing Kyoto, but Eddie Goldenberg made a very interesting admission that when the Liberals signed Kyoto, it was for public relations purposes. He actually said that it was to galvanize public opinion, that they had no plan. That's probably why Canada had one of the worst records in the world under the Liberals. So people should know that. The Liberals are very good at talking a good game on the environment, but they don't actually get the job done. The Conservatives, on the other hand, are disastrous for the environment, but at least they're consequential with themselves. They've scrapped large sections of the Navigable Waters Protection Act, the Fisheries Act, the Species at Risk Act. We don't even have real, credible, thorough environmental assessments in this country anymore. So against that backdrop, we're going to take, again, the situation that we get when we form government, but anything that we sign on to will actually get done.
Various ideas have been floated. Would $30 per ton be too much, do you think? Would $40 per ton be too much for oil sands?
These are subjects that I've worked on in great detail. We're going to have to take the dossier in the shape it's in when we form government. We don't have enough information on where Canada is right now, and we're going to work hard. We're going to be at the table in Paris. We're going to make sure that we sign on to something. It'll be constraining, and we'll respect it. And then we'll make sure that we put in place a system to attain it. Cap and trade is the only way to ensure the result. A carbon tax can be an adjunct. Some provinces are using that, but it can't produce the result in a guaranteed way the same way a cap and trade system was. We'll do it. That's what we're going to be pushing for, and we'll get the results, and we'll get it done.
That was NDP leader Thomas Mulcair speaking about the NDP's perspective on greenhouse gas emissions and the oil and gas industry. For another perspective, I also spoke with University of Alberta economist and Maclean's contributor Andrew Leach. To hear my conversation with Andrew, check out the Maclean's on the Hill page at macleans.ca.
Still to come on the show, we speak with the new national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. After that, we talk to the Aboriginal Affairs Minister. And later, the Maclean's panel brings us the best and the worst of the fall sitting of Parliament. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Maclean's panel weighs in on the fall sitting of Parliament. But first,
this week, the Assembly of First Nations elected its new National Chief. After only one round of voting, Perry Bellegarde was chosen to represent First Nations people and replace former Chief Sean Atleo, who resigned from the position. Bellegarde is a member of the Little Black Bear First Nation in Saskatchewan, and in one of his previous roles, he served as President of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations.
His election victory comes as Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcour indicates he wants to deal less with the AFN and more with individual communities. Now, our interview with the minister will be coming up in a few minutes, but first, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with the new chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde.
Do you expect to be talking to the Prime Minister sometime soon?
Yes, I'm going to be in Ottawa next week, okay. And so I'll be reaching out, and I'm hoping that the Prime Minister's office and his officials are also reaching out, because we need to establish that dialogue sooner than later.
And what would you want to talk about at a first sit-down with him?
Well, I think we want to start talking about map out a strategy and plan going forward. There's many, many issues we need to resolve here in Canada. You know, we want to start a process to acknowledge and implementing First Nations rights and title, including Aboriginal rights and title, including treaty rights. We need to find processes to establish those. We need to continue a dialogue on what we do about the cries and calls for an inquiry into missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls, because 3/4 of Canadians want that inquiry to happen. We got to deal with children in care issues. We got to deal with the revitalization of our languages issues. We got to deal with how do we close the fiscal gap that exists in education, or how do we deal with establishing a new fiscal relationship with the Crown, because the funding out to the community has been capped at 2% for the last 20 years.
Chief Bellegarde, there's a big agenda there, and I don't think anyone would question that those are all serious issues. But it seemed like your predecessor, Sean Atleo, focused on education, got a deal, and as a result of that, he was sort of pushed out, and it looked like, to some people, like even making progress on a significant file like that somehow isn't progress, that it actually just leads to more disruption and dissent inside the AFN. Do you think that's fair, that observation?
We have to really focus on education, no question, because we're all aware of the fiscal gap, the fiscal imbalance that's there. You know, the $6,500 per tuition per child on reserve versus the $10,500 in provincial school systems versus the almost $20,000 in the French school system. There's a 40% fiscal gap that exists. So we
less
need to find processes.
Less being spent per pupil or per student per in reserves than what
student.
Kids officers are getting. Yeah,
exactly.
It seems grossly unfair, but wasn't there a deal to put almost $2 billion into the system? I mean, why didn't that just go ahead?
Because it infringed on First Nations jurisdiction and didn't have the principle of Indian control of Indian education at its base. And so now, we just talked about it with the Chiefs' Assembly, they passed the motion to start looking at a fiscal framework agreement, you know, a new fiscal framework with the Crown to deal with the inequities in educational. So when it comes to education, the Chiefs have given direction now.
I think a lot of Canadians were moved by the very sort of quiet, shy, but still kind of forceful way that Ronelle Harper talked about her experience and called for some kind of inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women. That's something the federal government has been pretty intransigent on. Do you see any hope for thinking that there'll be some kind of movement towards, I don't know, a compromise or some approach to an inquiry that the government could accept?
Well, I would say never deprive people of hope, because sometimes that may be all they have left, you know, and we need to keep pushing forward with this issue. Ronelle made a powerful presentation. You know, it's so powerful. 3/4 of Canadian people in Canada want an inquiry into missing Indigenous women and girls. That's a lot of people. I encourage them to talk to their members of Parliament, push their members of Parliament to do the right thing and get this inquiry started sooner than later. You know, there's root causes of that whole issue, you know, that have to be addressed, like adequate housing, like more daycare services, like wellness centers. The list will go on and on, but you need to push for that national inquiry, because that will shed light on the issue, create an education process, an awareness process, will lead to understanding, will hopefully lead to an action plan to get a coordinated approach in developing that action plan to end violence against Indigenous women and girls.
What about the internal divisions within the AFN? At the time that Sean Atleo was exiting, some chiefs I talked to were quite candid in saying that they thought that things were in disarray, that there was a lot of confusion over the role of the AFN, the degree to which it could speak with sort of one voice for more than 500 different First Nations across the country. Do you think that the organization itself is at some kind of turning point now?
Well, I don't believe it's at a turn. I think we need to continue to build the trust and respect amongst the chiefs and leadership across Canada, continue to move toward and build on a national organization that's effective and efficient, you know, in terms of promoting transformational change that's required. You know, we have a new strong mandate. We need the energy of our youth. We need the wisdom of our elders, and we need the balance and strength of the women's voices around our tables. And I'm going to continue to advocate for that.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with the new National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde.
There is hope Bellegarde's election could mark a turning point in the AFN's rocky relationship with the Harper government. To get a sense of what might happen next, John Geddes also sat down this week with Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcourt. Valcourt has been stressing economic development on reserves and accountability for First Nations at the local level. But first, John asked him about renewed demands for an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
I know that your focus has been on education, economic development, what are kind of pragmatic stepping stones, to improvement. But there's been a lot of emphasis on the missing Aboriginal women and girls, and especially with the story of Ronelle Harper in Winnipeg. What do you say to that? Would it not be easier to agree to some form of process now, if only just to alleviate the pressure on that file? Why not just say we'll do something to try to address that concern?
Well, I guess it's because, you know, of the fundamental difference in between us and them. And when I say them, I mean the NDP and the Liberals. I mean, you know, some people like to give themselves a good conscience by throwing money at a problem. But we, and you know, I think the record will prove what I'm saying, is that instead we are going to look at the structural things that we can do to change things. Mm. Let's take the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Of course, the numbers are, you know, outrageous over a period of 30 years. But then, what must you do about it? Well, when you consider, for example, that 90% of the victims are victims of whom? People they knew, husbands, common law partners, friends, living on reserve or outside, but, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, why are women treated like this? Well, you know, these women in Canada living on reserve were not like the non-Aboriginal women living outside reserve. In the case of a marriage breakdown, she had no right whatsoever. She and her kids, you know, could be thrown out of the house without rights. So that does not create within any community a lot of respect for women. They have no rights. Well, if you are really concerned about changing things in a structural way to change behaviors, well, why not give those women the same rights as other Canadian women have? And I'm just, you know, and I'm sincere when I say this. Okay, to me, the Family Home and Marital Property Rights Act, you know, which we have passed to put Indian women on reserve at the same level as non-Aboriginal, not just for the sake of saying they are equal, but to build within that community the realization that women do have rights, kids do have rights, and they must be respected. And that will achieve that, not overnight, but in the long term, what we are going to see because of that law that is now applicable on reserve, well, maybe, just maybe, that the little boys are going to look at the women and girls and say, whoops, they have rights too.
But let's say we stipulate that all that is true.
Yep.
Isn't it possible that an inquiry of some form could address the issue, but address those exact factors? Why couldn't an inquiry look at it through that practical, realistic lens?
Listen, we, you know, there have been some 40 studies made. I mean, you know, someone, to me, you know, to me, a national inquiry is an excuse for not taking action. We know. I mean, come on. I mean, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure it out, okay? The problem is, you know, we have the impact and the result of this policy of residential schools, okay? The intergenerational impact of this, you know, that's a manifestation of it. The lack of education, the lack of economic development taking place at the community level so that they can become, you know, more self-sufficient, enter the labor market. I mean, these, a national inquiry would outline all of this and say these are the root causes.
Right.
And that's what we have to work on. And that's exactly what we're doing. So instead of spinning our wheels on trying to give us good conscience by wanting to find out how and why, well, let's do it. I mean, the minister, I mean, of Status of Women came up with this plan in September where, you know, actions are being outlined that addresses the very issue and the measures that can be taken. Now, I'm sorry, you know, it makes people feel good that, you know, someone else should take ownership of the problem. Well, the problem has to be taken ownership of at the community level.
Minister, you've talked about the need to act on the local and regional level, but we do have a new national chief this week, Perry Bellegarde. I have talked to him yesterday. First of all, do you have plans to meet with him? And secondly, how much importance do you put on the changing of the guard at the AFN?
Well, listen, I mean, you know, of course, you know, I will meet with the national chief when he has to meet, you know.
I think he's here next week.
I know him. Yeah, I've known National Chief Bellegarde now for a number of years. So, yes, you know, and we're going to keep working with him. And but, you know, but I'm not kidding myself, you know, the evidence is there. I mean, the national chief you know, is very limited in terms of what he can do and the following he can bring with him on any issue.
This is proven by the Sean Atleo example.
Yeah, and so many other files also. Mm. So, I mean, you know, First Nations are diverse over a great, great, great country. And, you know, that's why I think we have to pay more attention to where we can get the real results. And I think that this is at the community and regional level. But we will keep on working with the national chief and see, you know, how we can progress. But the real progress is at the community level.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcourt.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the fall sitting of Parliament. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined today by political editor for McLean's, Paul Wells, as well as McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me, guys. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll just say that we will have a detailed look at 2014 and do a year-in-review McLean's panel coming up in our year-end special episode, but right now we're going to focus on the fall session. So I'll start with you, Paul. What stood out for you? What caught your eye through the fall session?
I think it was the extent to which Canadian parliamentarians remain buffeted by outside events. I mean, those of us who work on the Hill are always tend to treat it as sort of a closed system where the important decisions are made. But the important events in the world that really affected Canada were still the Russian adventure in Ukraine. It was ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It was the beginning of the collapse of the price of petroleum, which could have really long-term effects in Canada, and the continued refusal of the Obama administration to even give a straight answer on Keystone. And so it was within that broader context that everything that we saw this fall happened, I think.
So, John, what do you think are some of the key issues that popped up in the fall session and the storyline in your eyes?
Well, I think once we got away from the two big things, the attack on Parliament Hill and the questions of sexual misconduct among MPs, which those were important things that soaked up a lot of energy and attention, but really aren't key policy files, really. Once we got our attention pulled away from those, the big things that happened included the fact that the government took a real albatross around its neck, left over from the 2011 campaign, a promise to allow income splitting for families for tax purposes, a frankly lousy tax policy the way it stood. Looked like a horrible thing that they were going to have to deal with, and they turned into quite a clever, more complex family tax packages, much more difficult for people to attack. There are still people attacking it, don't get me wrong, but much more difficult to attack because it broadens some benefits out for more people. And what it reminded us of was these guys are no fools, right? They could see that if they tried to implement the policy the way it was promised in 11, it would be a disaster for them. So they came up with a much craftier policy and delivered it with the Prime Minister at a sort of campaign-style event down near Toronto with families on stage, and looked like much more a government that knew how to grab the agenda, not give easy targets to the opposition.
You mentioned the campaign event, so let's talk about that a little bit, because it seemed like politicians were trying to make news in communities and cities across the country rather than actually being on Parliament Hill. And of course, we all know this is pretty much the start of the 2015 election campaign for these leaders. How did the leaders fare in your eyes out there on this pre-campaign trail, if you will?
I think the big surprise is that Stephen Harper still knows how to campaign and plans to do some of it over the next year, because we tend to look at the newer faces, the less familiar faces, Tom Mulcair and Justin Trudeau. Mulcair had mentioned when I interviewed him at the end of August a bunch of areas in which he hoped to make some headlines and identify NDP policy. I challenge anyone to name those areas today. And Justin Trudeau draws big crowds, but he mostly says to those big crowds, "You're great, we're great, Canada's great." And meanwhile, Harper had this string of events. Began with the when he was in the United Nations in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, he was interviewed by the editor of the Wall Street Journal, and he gave sort of the broad outlines of his economic vision, and then he gave the announcement on the tax package, on infrastructure, on international development assistance, on support for science research. it was eloquent demonstration that the prime minister runs a government and can announce things, where the other guys can only promise things.
And one more thing that I'm sure you had in the back of your mind as well, in that list of ways the prime minister kind of came back to dominate the agenda. You know, when foreign policy and especially foreign wars are in the headlines, a prime minister has a built-in advantage. But in this particular case, we watched the prime minister seeming very sure-footed, don't have to agree with them, but very sure-footed on the Ukraine, and especially on sending Canadian fighter jets into Iraq. And Justin Trudeau and Thomas Mulcair had trouble crafting a message that was resonating in those on those files. And Justin Trudeau, one wouldn't want to overstate the importance of this, but on the day that he tried to put his stamp on, no, I'm not for us sending bombers into Iraq, he also made a silly juvenile joke, which any day would have been a minor gaffe, a silly joke. But on a day when he wanted people to focus on that well-crafted speech that he had, it's more than a little gaffe. It's kind of like a big distraction. And it just shows that bad timing, awkward delivery can affect things.
And that fits into the narrative from the Conservatives that Justin Trudeau isn't ready to lead and he's inexperienced and he'll make gaffes like that. It's clear that the Prime Minister overshadowed Mulcair and Trudeau on those events outside of Parliament Hill. Was there anything that impressed you at all between the NDP and Liberal leaders?
Well, Tom Mulcair is always a very impressive guy. He's well briefed on files. Someone has gotten to him and told him, "You must not be angry, sir." And so he is the smilingest guy you ever did see. He had a good night on Halloween when he dressed as an angry bird.
That was fun.
From the video game.
Love that.
Justin Trudeau. By now, we've learned the shtick, you know.
And expectations are high for him, eh, now, Paul?
Yeah.
They're high for Justin.
I'm struck. I had a book out last year, so I got really good at tracking sales of books. And I'm struck by how the Trudeau memoir, Common Ground, has fallen far short of what the publisher expected in terms of sales. I think there's a Trudeau comfort among Canadians. There's a Trudeau intrigue, but there's not a lot of Trudeau mania out there.
John, do you think that there was anything impressive out of Trudeau's performance this
year? I think, as I was sort of alluding earlier, I mean, we've already been impressed by Trudeau, and on the grounds for which we can be impressed, the fact that he's generally a likable guy, an interesting person in front of a crowd who can hold people's attentions, all those great skills that he's gotten, we've sort of seen that, right? So this was a fall when there was a lot of substance in the air, foreign policy, tax policy, energy policy, and this sounds like it's just buying the line of his critics, but there were a number of moments where he might have impressed us with his ability to seem confident and to say something new and something fresh on those files, and he really didn't do it, that I can recall. Mulcair did have an interesting package on daycare to announce, but boy, he kind of got blown out of the headlines by all the other stuff that was going on Parliament Hill, like including the harassment, misconduct allegations, the shooting. It was hard for someone to carve out some space for a new policy idea in that environment.
All right, and you mentioned the harassment and the other issues that dominated the headlines. Of course, the shooting, a very big event that, you know, shook our whole country to its core. We did have those harassment allegations that rocked Parliament Hill and shocked many people. But did both of these events sort of highlight how unprepared Parliament may have been to deal with, albeit very different issues, but with some of these issues?
Certainly the sexual harassment. I mean, it suggests that this is essentially, in a lot of places, not a mature workplace. And that a lot of the old lore about Ottawa persists long after it should have. And it's certainly long past time for some kind of formal institutional response to these sorts of allegations to be put in place. I mean, those two male ex-Liberal MPs are still hanging out there without any forum to respond to the accusations against them, without any identified accusers. And they may be guilty, they may be innocent. There's no way to establish which of those two they are, and there's an election looming, and they're going to want a campaign. The shooting, I think, gives Parliament Hill a bad rap. Any ingenious and motivated attacker can find weaknesses in any armor.
But John, did it expose some security gaps on Parliament Hill?
Yes.
Because he was able to run right up without being stopped at all and run right through those front doors where unarmed guards had to struggle with
him
right off the start.
I think it goes without saying that there were gaps. But I would also say I think it was fortunate, in a weird, twisted way, fortunate that a guy had run straight into the east wing of the White House shortly before this. I talked to a very senior expert on security on Capitol Hill in the U.S. who said to me, you know, one thing we've learned in recent years is a headstrong, determined runner is a hard person to deal with. You can have techniques around vehicles, you can have techniques around someone who tries to sneak in, but if someone just starts running, it's hard to come up with a system. Not impossible. Of course improvements can be made, but it's nice to reminder, it was good that we had that in the recent past when it happened on Parliament Hill, because it didn't lead to people saying, this is just a Bush League Mickey Mouse thing. It's in London and Paris and Washington, this would never have happened. No, it does happen other places. This sort of thing is hard to guard against, which is not to say you can't do better. And I think they are doing better already on the Hill and will probably do better in the future in terms of trying to prevent the most obvious ways that someone could cause a horrible disruption on the Hill.
All right, and we'll finish off by doing the traditional thing on the end of session or end of year
panels. You're
going to
give us gifts? Are you giving us gifts? Is that what this is?
Not made of money. But we're going to do the winners and losers.
Winners and losers.
Yeah, who do you think are the winners and losers of the fall session? Paul, we'll start with you.
I think Stephen Harper is the winner, or at least to the extent that he seems to have stopped losing. To the extent that he seems to be off the mat and back in the fight for the next election. I mean, there are probably still people who expect him to quit rather than fight next year, but I think that number is dwindling, and I think there's a sense that he's going to be around next year. Losers? Bloc Québécois.
Yes.
This guy, Mario, what's his name, who wants to... I make a point of honor not to learn his name, who was going to revitalize the Bloc by making it more extreme, lost half of his caucus, and then threw out the policy that was the basis for those people leaving. I mean, best of luck to them in the next election.
I agree with Paul on Stephen Harper as being a big, looks like a winner of this thing. Just to give a more narrowly focused thing, we have Bernard Valcourt, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister, on our show this week, and he's a guy who pushed through a controversial transparency law for First Nations. Many people predicted a massive backlash, all kinds of disruption, protests. He got more than 90% compliance with his new law, a muted backlash. I think that has to stand as a victory in that very difficult file. So I'd say that Bernard Valcourt had a good few months. You know what? The big losers in Canadian politics weren't on the Hill this fall, were they? I mean, you look at even for the year, we were looking at people like Olivia Chow, who we knew very well here, went down to Toronto with high hopes of becoming mayor and really fared horribly in the mayoral election there. We watched the collapse of major politicians at the provincial level across the country. Things seemed almost a little bit safe and static on Parliament Hill compared to some of that stuff.
All right, thanks very much for joining me today. Political editor for Maclean's, Paul Wells. Ottawa Bureau Chief for Maclean's, John Geddes. And I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.